You know, when we look around in the world today, we don't see a lot of things that people can foster faith and hope in. Every time you read a headline, you see something else that just simply tells you that you cannot have faith in human beings, human governments, human modes of operandis. They just simply do not have the ability to be able to do things in a manner and in a way that would lead you to believe that you would have faith in them. You know, on the converse, you can look out at the workings of things that man has created, like the Hubble telescope. That came on the scene some 2+ decades ago, and it has greatly altered our vision of space and the things of space. From our finite eye, I'm talking about our human finite eye, we see things basically out as far as the human eye can see, but beyond that, we just simply do not know. This Hubble telescope has allowed us to be able to look into the past in some respects, out into space, billions and billions of years ago, to see things that we couldn't even begin to comprehend. When you go back and you look at the galaxies, you know, we talk about the Milky Way, we talk about this galaxy that we are a part of. But when you begin to understand that the Hubble telescope has helped us to understand that this is not the only galaxy that exists, and the 9 planets that we commonly learned when we were in elementary school or junior high, those are not the only planets that exist. It's awesome to think about and to see, to begin to realize of all these stars that exist, how many, perhaps billions, have burned out, others have been created through time. The billions and billions of years to think about these things, we can't even begin to comprehend. It's awesome to see those things. It's awesome to contemplate those things and to think of the work of God the Father and Jesus Christ, who has created all these things. When we look at things from that perspective, it tends perhaps to frame a different look at the subject of faith for us. We talk a lot about faith, and oftentimes we look at our faithfulness to God. Are we being faithful to God? But I'd like to turn that around today and look at it in a somewhat different way. I'd like today to look at God's faithfulness towards us. We talk about growing in faith, all rightfully so, but what about the converse of this relationship that we have with the Creator of the universe? What about our God and His faithfulness to us? The title for the sermon this afternoon is The God of Faithfulness. The God of Faithfulness. I want to begin at the outset here to take a look at a few examples in the Old Testament. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 8. Genesis chapter 8. When we look at this particular topic, as we get into Genesis chapter 8, we are coming into the tail end here of Noah's life. We're coming to the point where God had used Noah as a powerful prophet, as a powerful individual, that he would save Noah and his family, that he would utterly destroy mankind, because again, as we read, as we read in chapter 6, that mankind had simply become evil and perverse all of the time, continually, constantly. God would use this man, Noah, but he would do something with regards to what had happened and occurred. He had told Noah what he wanted him to do. I want you to build this ark with specific dimensions. And I want you to grab these animals, 2 by 2, everything that creeps on the earth. And I'm going to flood this earth, and you and your family are going to be shut up in this ark, and you will continue the human race when all mankind has died. Let's pick the story up, though, in Genesis chapter 8, because there is something here that shows us the faithfulness that God showed to Noah, but in the same way, it's a sign for us today, and I think maybe some of you already know perhaps where I'm going. Notice Genesis chapter 8 and verse 1. He says, "Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark, and God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. This is an interesting statement that is made in verse 1, that God remembered Noah. He remembered Noah. God had been faithful to Noah before the flood, all the way to the time during the flood and even after the flood. And so now we see the situation here where the waters have receded, the ark has come to rest, and they have the ability to now come out onto dry land for the first time in some months. Let's pick the story up in verse 9. What we are finding here is that a covenant had been made between God and Noah. God remembered Noah. He was faithful to what he had promised. The great lesson for us up to this particular point is that when God enters into a covenant, when he enters into a contract, he is faithful to do his part. We never have to worry about whether or not God is going to fulfill his part. As was stated by Mr. Olson in the sermonette, when we talk about conforming our minds, when we go to God and seek the help to conform, or to transform, and to change the person that we are, and to allow that work to be done in us, we recognize that we work to overcome, but we don't have to worry about the righteousness that is being built by God in us. We don't have to wonder, is God doing his part? Just as God remembered Noah, he remembers us. So it's a promise that we can look to. It's a promise that should give us comfort. People will let us down all the time, will they not? How many times have you been let down by a human being? But God never lets us down. He remembers us just the way he remembered Noah. Let's pick up the story, Genesis chapter 9, and let's pick it up in verse 9. And he says, as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. So he is talking not only about Noah, his sons, all the way on down the line. This is something that goes to us today. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth, thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. Perpetual means on and on. It means what it means. Verse 13, I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. God established his covenant with not only Noah, but to human beings of all life on this earth. So when we look up and we see that rainbow, it is a reminder, yes, that that happened and occurred, a sign that God gave to Noah that I would not flood the earth ever again like I did. But that promise of faithfulness to Noah was not just to him, it is to us as well, as it says there, as we just read. It is a perpetual covenant. Verse 14, it shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. Again, as I said, I reiterate, the rainbow is a reminder that even when God looks at, he is reminded of the covenant. Now, God does not need to be reminded. But we come to understand the relationship that the God of the universe has with human beings. And just as we see that rainbow, he sees that rainbow, and he is reminded. It reminds us both of that relationship and the involvement in our lives. God gives us a promise. He shows his faithfulness to us. It is a remember connection. It is a remember connection between God and us. God is very faithful to his people in a physical way, but again, also in a spiritual way as well. Let's look at another example here over in Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, we are introduced to the individual Abram, that before his name changed to Abraham, would be that individual who is often referred to, among other things, as the father of the faithful. The Abrahamic covenant is something that God entered into with Abram, later to become Abraham. The realization is that promise goes to us as well. We are, again, recipients of that promise that God gave to Abraham. Notice Genesis chapter 12, beginning in verse 2. Actually, let's begin in verse 1. He says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" This is a staggering promise. This again goes back to the promise of the covenant that was made with Noah. The realization that I am going to make you the family in which I bring mankind back and develop this land. Here, in much the same way with Abraham, he said, "It is this covenant that I'm entering into. I'm sealing it with my name." And the standpoint of this particular covenant tells us, when he makes that statement in verse 3, "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed," God is putting his very character into this covenant as much as any other covenant. We go back to the understanding, the realization of character, that it is not within the character of God the Father and Jesus Christ to lie. They're not capable of doing that. It's not part of godly character. So when he makes this promise to Abram, he's making it clear that there is something that is staggering here. Turn with me over to chapter 17 now. We find Abraham onto Isaac, onto Jacob, down to Joseph. It carries with us today. But I want you to take a look here in chapter 17, and let's read a few verses, because again, I want to see the magnitude of this particular promise, this connection between God and Abraham and his family to us today. Notice Genesis chapter 17, beginning in verse 1. He says, "When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly.'" Let's drop down to verse 5. "No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you." Now think about what he is promising at this particular moment. He's saying, not only are you going to be blessed, not only are you and your wife going to be blessed and your offspring are going to be blessed, but I am going to make them royalty. Kings will come from you. Nations will come from you. Let's drop down to verse 15. We find the situation here, picking up the story. Verse 15. "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her.'" Notice verse 17. "Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, 'Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?'" Here we find a staggering promise. Again, you go back to the standpoint of understanding miracles that exist and occur. And the realization here is that Abraham is looking at this from a human perspective, saying, "That's all well and good, but I don't see this happening. I'm 100 years old. She's 99. She's now barren. This isn't going to happen." But remember that it was a covenant promise. There is a faithfulness that goes into God working with his servants, and the human standpoint or the physical aspect of it was not important to God, because he knew that he had the ability. He had the ability to again bless Abraham, perform that miracle, allow Sarah to be pregnant, and ultimately to be giving birth to Isaac. So we find this staggering promise. We see it go down the bloodline. Now again, we go through the story. I'll speed it up here a little bit, looking and realizing that Israel, the nation of Israel, that ultimately what God was after was this model nation. That Israel never really lived up to what God wanted, but he was using that standpoint and moving us now to the point where we are the spiritual nation of Israel. We individually, as we find that God is working with us one-on-one in a faithful way, but we are the spiritual nation of Israel today. That is why we have the church today. It started with a promise to Abraham. As Jesus Christ leads the church, we become that perfected nation. We become those individuals who have been transformed. Whether it is just here with the few that we have in the Pacific Northwest, in the United States, or around the world, we are a spiritual nation. This all comes as what? It all comes as an end result of God's faithfulness to Abraham. We look at the challenges the church has faced in the 2+ decades, but God has also always been faithful to us, just as he was faithful to Abraham. Let's pick it up in chapter 19, Genesis chapter 19 and verse 19. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 19, we find a situation in which God looked after Abraham. Again, the story here, this is prior to or coming to the situation where Lot, Sodom, and Gomorrah is going to be destroyed. Notice verse 19, the statement that is made here. Indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. In spite of everything that was going on physically around them, God's plan was not so great and everything happening and occurring with what he had promised Abraham that he did not remember the person of Abraham, that there was not mercy that was extended to Abraham, and that Abraham was protected. We find that throughout the Old Testament with several individuals that we come in contact with, that they were always taken care of by God, even with Joseph. With everything that he went through as an end result, not of his own things that he did, but things that happened to him, God was still faithful to Joseph. He was faithful to Joseph when he was sold into slavery. He was faithful to Joseph when ultimately he was framed and put in prison. He was faithful to Joseph when he came before Pharaoh and ultimately became the equivalent of what we would consider the governor of Egypt, where everything was under his hand. Again, under the Pharaoh. We see a side of God in which we realize that he is a part of people's lives. But it is not a situation where he does not listen to his servants as well. That he is not faithful to listen to us when we have need or when we interject or we ask God for something. Let's turn over to Numbers chapter 14. I want to take a look at just one example of this. Here in Numbers chapter 14, we find the example of Moses. Moses had more patience than I think I probably would have had dealing with Israel. He had to have patience with them over and over and over again. It simply got to the point with God that he ultimately had had enough. He had laid out everything for the promised land. He had shown them. He had told them. He had delivered on his part of the contract, the promise. And now here they were, right on the cusp of entering into the promised land, and they didn't want to go. Two of them were going to be faithful and say, yes, we can do it. And the other 10 said, no, it's too much. As I said last week in the sermon, it's just not worth it. This got to the point where God had had enough. He had had enough. Let's pick it up in Numbers chapter 14 and verse 11. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will these people reject me, and how long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? I mean, think about what had happened up to that particular moment in time. They had wanted water. Well, let's go back before that. They had been pursued by Pharaoh's army. He had parted the Red Sea. They had wanted water 3 days after parting the Red Sea. He had provided for that. They wanted food. He provided that. They didn't want the manna. They wanted meat. He gave them quail. They provoked him and provoked him and provoked him. As they spoke to Moses, he says, how long do I have to continue this? How long are they going to continue to provoke me? How long are they not going to see that I've been faithful to them? Verse 12. I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. Now, at that particular moment in time, I suppose the human reasoning might have kicked in for Moses. Because all along the way, he had to kind of be the buffer between them and God. And he might have thought there for a second, say, let me see here for a moment. Continue and listen to the stiff-necked, rebellious people, or just have God wipe them out. Let's just start all over. Yeah, I mean, starting all over, that might make sense. Maybe you're right. Maybe that is a good plan. Maybe that's something we ought to do. But notice what he does, verse 13. And Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear it. For by your might you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, Lord, are among these people, that you, Lord, are seen face to face, and your cloud stand above them, and you could go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you kill these people as one man, then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, because the Lord was not able to bring this people to the land, which he swore to them, therefore he killed them in the wilderness. Moses interceded for the people. Moses was more concerned about what people would say about God than what he was worried about the people would say. His concern was, you know, if you want to do that, that's up to you. But understand that Egypt and the nations will say, he couldn't deliver. This God that the Israelites claimed was so powerful and so great could not deliver on the promise. This is a God that you can't have faith in. That faithfulness, though, that, again, he showed was to God's people down through time. As I said before, that faithfulness is not just for Abraham and not just for his immediate offspring. It is for us. Notice over in Isaiah chapter 42. Isaiah chapter 42. What we see here is something that had been very foreign, but what God is showing through Isaiah's writings that it was not just of Abraham's descendants that would be blessed and receive the goodness of God. In other words, we find a prophetic statement that is being made here. Notice Isaiah chapter 42, beginning in verse 1. Isaiah chapter 42, and let's pick it up in verse 1. He says, behold, my servant whom I upheld, my elect one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out nor raise his voice nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastland shall wait for his law. Now, was he talking about Abraham's physical descendants here? No, this is a prophetic statement that goes all the way back to Jesus Christ. This is speaking of the time of Jesus Christ's return. It's showing us that not only is God concerned with Abraham's descendants physically in his bloodline, but we're talking about the spiritual bloodline that exists today, the spiritual nation of Israel, the church of God. Notice verse 5. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles. I will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people. God is concerned not only with the descendants of Israel, but he is concerned for all peoples. God's concern is for all peoples of the world, all cultures, all classes of people. we come to realize that when we have our public proclamation in the church of God, and what we do and how we are able to succeed, whether it is 600, 800, 900,000 hits on our Life, Hope, and Truth website in a month, it is not because of some special doing of ourselves, but that it is God's faithfulness to us as we do a work. When Mr. Franks makes the statement, and when Mr. Taylor tells you that the increase of the income is, what, 13% over last year, but we don't have a 13% increase in attendance, where is that coming from? Were we able to invest money in some way and make 13% in 1 year? No. We were able to again see that God is working with us in such a way that He is blessing the work. When people talk about how great a work they are doing, oh, how important the work that we are doing is in terms of what I physically myself am doing, it negates God. God is faithful to provide. God is able to do these things. It ultimately is a work of faith. So we go back to understand and realize that just as we read this scripture here, this passage of scripture in Isaiah chapter 42, that our proclamation, our good news of a coming kingdom, is for all peoples on the face of the earth, all cultures, all classes of people, regardless of who they are. They will all have to come to the same conclusion. They will all have to come to the realization that they have fallen short of the glory of God. They will all have to come to the realization that they have probably preconceived notions that they have learned over time that they will have to dismiss, that they will have to unlearn. These are the things that are going to have to happen in the millennium. And again, I simply say in the millennium, that does not mean there will be not those that are called as first fruits as God chooses to call them. My point goes back to God is faithful to do what is necessary to make certain and sure that we are doing a work. We continue to do that. And it must be done up until the time of the return of Jesus Christ. There is no time in which it stops. The responsibility of the church is to proclaim that message and to help make disciples of those whom God may call. It continues. And again, God is faithful to us to be able to do that work. I'd like to spend some time here in the latter half of the sermon to talk about God's faithfulness to provide. When you think about faithfulness to provide, what comes to mind? Now, I would dare say that in most cases, if we talk about faithfulness to provide, perhaps the first thing that comes to mind is the quote-unquote Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. These are the things that we think of in terms of God being faithful to provide. But I want you to turn over to John chapter 9, because we're going to go through a passage here in John chapter 9 that I believe is most instructive. John chapter 9. We're going to see an example here in John chapter 9 of God's faithfulness to provide. Now, the backdrop for this particular story that we're going to go through is that Jesus Christ's last, he is going to be attending his last fall feast before he would be crucified. We see an aspect of Jesus Christ's ministry in which he is able and willing to provide for people's personal needs. And what it does, I believe, is it reinforces us and shows us a powerful example of God's faithfulness. When we read this story, again, we look at it from the standpoint of the historics, and it's most interesting to look at it from a historic perspective. But then we must extrapolate it out and see that is something in terms of the faithfulness to provide that he does for us as well. Let's pick this story up in John chapter 9. In verse 1, it says, "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. Now, you think about that for a moment. Someone who had been blind from birth, you realize that there have been situations where you may have had family, you may have had your own children that have been involved in some sort of physical malady, some sort of a physical illness, something that has happened and occurred. But think of it from the perspective of the mother and father. When that statement is made, that this is a man who had been blind from birth, who had never had the opportunity to see. This is not a situation where he had his sight for a few years. Maybe by the age of six, something happened, occurred, he lost his sight, or he started to lose his sight, but at least for some period of time, he had had sight. Let's pick it up in verse 2. And his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." Now again, to understand the historic perspective is the Jews believed that if someone had a physical problem, a physical malady, a physical illness, a sickness, whatever it might be, that they had sinned as an end result, and that's why that physical ailment had come upon them. Therefore, when the disciples saw this man who was blind from birth, the first thing that got into their mind was the human programming of the Jewish culture that said, well, either the child has sinned or mom and dad have sinned. Those are the only three individuals involved with this thing that would end up making for this child to be blind. Jesus Christ makes it very clear. Not the man, not the parents. No one has sinned. Again, as I said before, what were these parents going through? Seeing your child with a deficiency, an illness, a malady. Now, as we're going to see through reading here, several things are works that are going to happen in this man's life. This should have been a time of tremendous joy for these parents. Think about that for a moment. Do you know someone in your family? Do you know someone who is a friend? Do you know someone who has had something, some sort of illness? And think about for a moment if they had been healed of that illness. What kind of joy would that bring to the person? What kind of joy would that bring to you to know that person, to know they had been healed? We're going to find that this individual is going to be healed. So it should have been a time of tremendous joy. But it's going to be destroyed by a squadron of self-righteous, sanctimonious hypocrites. The Pharisees, the numbskulls, the idiots. These people had to destroy the joy that was brought into somebody's life. And yet, what we see here as we read on is this account of this blind man's healing. Pick it up in verse 4. He says, "I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Had never been able to see the light of day. This is not a child. Again, the reference that John is giving us is he is a young man. How long had he gone without being able to see? His eyes are opened. Talk about the joy that this young man had to have. The joy that he could finally see his parents. Verse 8, "Therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, 'Is not this he who sat and begged?'" Here he would be outside on the street, outside on the road, outside of perhaps the temple or the synagogue, and begging for money. And they're seeing this individual walking around and not running into things. And the question is, well, isn't that Joe? The young man who's been blind since birth. Verse 9, some said, "This is he." Others said, "He is like him." He said, "I am he." Verse 10, "Therefore they said to him, 'How were your eyes opened?' He answered and said, 'A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and I received sight. He told me what to do. I did it and I can see.'" Verse 12, "Then they said to him, 'Where is he? talking again of this man, he said, Jesus. He said, I do not know. Verse 13, they brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees. Now the story is going to take an ugly turn. The Sabbath day in Jesus Christ's ministry was not complete without a visit from the scribes and the Pharisees. As I've said before, and I'll say it again, they could screw up a one-car funeral. These guys were idiots. They would have all kinds of various things to try and shake up the Sabbath day. Here we see that Jesus Christ had healed this young man on the Sabbath day. Now again, they worshiped the day more than they worshiped God, and ultimately what they see is a man who had gone above and beyond and had done things outside of the hedge or the law that they had placed in terms of the Sabbath. So they bring them, the neighbors and whatnot in the public, bring this young man forward, and they ask the question of this man. It was on the Sabbath, verse 14, when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes, and the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Now, the Pharisees could have heard it from the public saying, this is what he told us. But they're not going to believe anybody else. They hear the young man. Well, we know what they said, but what actually happened? Again, here's this squadron of idiots coming in here to try and, there's got to be a bad situation going on. There's got to be something wrong here. Verse 16. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. Again, as I said before, there was a rule that was put in place by the Pharisees that you could not heal on the Sabbath. Go back and you read what they wrote, and you see that they would take better care of animals on the Sabbath than they would of human beings. If an animal was in distress, you could help the animal, but if an individual is in distress, you could not care for them until the Sabbath was over. They would take care of animals more than they would take care of human beings. This is how they thought. They treated animals better than human beings. Verse 17, then they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him because he opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. Verse 18, but the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. Wouldn't believe people around that had seen this man who had been blind from birth, wouldn't believe the individual who had been healed directly. Now we've got to go and we've got to ask the parents. Verse 19, and they asked them saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? Now, there's no indication that the parents were there when the healing was taking place. So in verse 20, his parents answered them, said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we don't know. We weren't there. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He's of age. Go ask him. Why are you asking us? He will speak for himself. Verse 23, or verse 22. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Now, in the back of their mind, obviously they had to believe and realize, is this Jesus of Nazareth? Is this individual who has been going around and healing people? Is it possible that this is the one who spat on the clay and made this plaster or whatnot of mud and put it on our son's eyes so that he could see? But there was also the realization that if they were to agree that it was Christ that had done this, they would be banned from entering into the synagogue. You find again that the Pharisees were very confrontational. They believed in retribution. You're going to allow yourself to be healed? You're going to allow your son to be healed? If you profess this man to be a prophet, say goodbye to coming to the synagogue to worship. There was some fear there. There was some concern. Verse 23. Therefore his parents said, he is of age. Ask him. In other words, once again, don't ask us. We weren't there. Ask him. He was there. Notice verse 24. So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." Again, trying to trap this young man. The whole point, going back to the very beginning of here, someone who's been blind from birth, showing a faithfulness of God to heal a young man. Verse 25, he answered and said, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, though, that I was blind and now I see." Then they said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did you open your eyes?" He probably felt like he was being interviewed by CNN at this point. "Are you stupid? Do you not get it? I've already told you twice." That's essentially what he says here in verse 27. He answered them, "I told you already. And you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? If I tell it to you again, are you going to tell me that you understand now? Do you also want to become his disciples? What's your motivation? Do you truly want to know so that ultimately you can become followers of his teachings? Or are you just looking to get him because he healed me on the Sabbath?" Verse 28. Then they reviled him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple." There is again an arrogance. Our teacher is better than your teacher. No understanding, no realization of what's going on. "We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from." The man answered and said to them, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, yet he has opened my eyes." In other words, this individual has to be connected to God for this healing to take place. There is no way that it could not have happened. This young man had a clear understanding of God. He had a clear understanding of his works, and he was able to make these statements without any sort of doubt. "I know who he is because he has opened my eyes." Verse 31, "Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." He's making it clear without stating it in so many words that he is in fact the Son of God. I mean, he is, give the man credit, he is putting it right back at the Pharisees. You got to love it. I mean, there's probably a crowd of them there, and it's one on who knows how many. And for every question that's coming back, he's firing right back, and he's not cowering. You got to love it. Verse 34, "They answered and said to him, 'You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?' And they cast him out." To make this statement to say that they've accused him of being born in sin, it is a hideous thing. It is the vilest of vile attitudes of the Pharisees, and it shows the hatred that they had for Jesus Christ. And they ended up putting him out of the synagogue. This man, this young man's life had been totally and completely changed, blind to sight. He had had his life turned upside down because now he was put out of the synagogue. Even his parents, in a sense, had abandoned him because of the fear of removal from the synagogue. Remember the statement, "He's of age, go ask him. Go ask him." This young man was all alone. He was isolated. Jesus Christ knew what it was like to be alone. So what would he do? He would go and he would get the young man. Just as he had gone in the Old Testament, just as we see that he had gotten Moses, just as he had gotten Abraham, just as he had gotten Jonah out of the belly of the fish, he went and got this young man. What it shows us is a faithfulness that God will do anything to get his servants. We are those servants. We are those servants in training now. The story that we read here of this young man blind from birth was a realization of not just this young man coming to the realization that God, that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And not just an understanding that he was faithful to provide a need. We find that God is faithful to us to provide the need that we may have. Jesus Christ knew this man needed more than just to have his sight healed. He needed a place to worship. He needed a place to hang his religious hat, so to speak, if I can use that term. Jesus Christ was going to take care of him. Notice verse 35. Jesus heard that he had been cast out, and when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Then he said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." We come to realize that not only was this young man healed physically, but there was a progression in his understanding. Notice in verse 11, it says there, when they were trying to find out how he had been healed, the statement is made in verse 11. He answered and said, "A man called Jesus." But there's a progression of thought. Notice verse 17. Then they said to the blind man again, "What do you say about him who opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." As Jesus was faithful to heal this man, so there was spiritually something that was happening here. There was a progression that was taking place with this young man. In other words, it was not just the physical act of healing. It went from a man named Jesus to a prophet to, as we read there in verse 35, that "You are the Son of God." Jesus Christ went back to him and stated, after all this is said and done, "I did this for you." The young man realized who he was in the presence of, and he worshiped him. He had been reminded of the example that God is always faithful to bring us to the point of understanding that we need to be in. We look at this particular story from the standpoint of just the physical healing, and that of itself is a tremendous miracle, but there is something more there. The realization was that this man needed to be taken care of spiritually. And there was a progression that took place as an end result of this story in chapter 9. Notice over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's go over there for a moment. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And notice verse 13. He says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common in man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." God has figured out the steps ahead of time. He knows the future. Thus, when we face the strenuous trials of this life, he is faithful to bring us to the point that we need to be in order to make our way through. When we understand that we have that faithful God, it helps us to turn those things in our lives over to him that we cannot handle ourselves. Now, sometimes we are blind to understand what God is trying to get us to learn. It's at those times that we have to ask God for the help and understanding to do what is right in our lives, rather than take away the trial, rather than take away the strain and the strenuous part of that particular moment in time. What are the lessons that you want me to learn? Not just deliver me from the stressful situation. You see, for ancient Israel, when God talked about those 10 times that Israel tempted him, tried him, tested him, what they didn't understand is the lessons they were supposed to be learning along the way. God was always faithful to them, but they didn't really learn the lessons. Some of them did, but not everybody. The point is the same for us. Don't just deliver us from the stressful situation. What are the lessons that you want me to learn from this? We know that because God is faithful to give us the answers and show us the way we make our way through the situations of life. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, notice verse 19. Hebrews chapter 10, and notice verse 19. He says, "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith." That statement is something that is, we read it and we simply say, yes, we should have that full assurance of faith. And to look at that and say, I need to have faith, you have to go back and realize, as we had just in a small part, how God is faithful to us. How he was faithful to Noah, and how we realize his faithfulness every time we see a rainbow. How we read the scripture and see the statement that is made that out of you, Abraham, I will make an exceedingly great nation, and kings will come out of you, nations will come out of you. We read that promise and we simply go, that wasn't just to Abraham, that's for us. We see this story of this young man who was blind from birth, who was, yes, healed of the physical malady, but more important than that, God was faithful to provide a need for him, not just physically, to get through this physical trial of health, the blindness, but I will take care of you now. You are one of my disciples. When we read this in full assurance of faith, the only stopping point has to be, do we believe that God is faithful to us? Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And we've just seen, we've just gone through this afternoon some of those examples. There is a God, and he is absolutely faithful to what he is doing and the life that he has given to us. Verse 24, "And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." God is quite capable of taking care of all humanity. He is capable of taking care of all life on planet Earth. He is capable of taking care of his physical house of Israel as he did. And brethren, he is well capable to take care of the spiritual house of Israel, the church of God. But what is most encouraging is that when we come to an understanding that that which he is doing in our lives as members of his family, his offspring, whether it is that young man, that individual who was given sight for the first time, he was faithful to him. He is faithful just like that to come after us and to give us the spiritual eyesight that we need. At times we may not know that we need it, but he is faithful to provide it. He knows, he comes, and he gives us that sight. Let's conclude by turning over to Isaiah chapter 57. The God of faithfulness. Yes, it is important for us to have faith. Yes, there is no one thing that will do us more instead in this life than to have faith. It requires it to be even stronger as we draw closer to the time of the return of Jesus Christ. Things are not getting better, they are getting worse. Things are getting more dire in the world that we live in today. Do we fear that? Do we worry that? Do we worry about those things? Or do we simply understand, yes, these things are going to happen, but my faith in God, because God is there. He is faithful to me. I will not surrender myself to the fears and the doubts that can crop up. Isaiah chapter 57. Notice verse 13. He says, when you cry out, let your collection of idols deliver you, but the wind will carry them all away. A breath will take them, but he who puts his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. And one shall say, heap it up, prepare the way, take the stumbling block out of the way of my people. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit. To revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones, for I will not contend forever, nor will I always be angry, for the spirit would fail before me and the souls which I have made. He made us. If we are committed to his will, he is transforming us. We understand that and realize that he will work us into the work of his hands because he is the God of faithfulness. We worship a God that inhabits eternity. We cannot begin to comprehend that fact in our human minds. God's greatest creation, I would submit to you, is the human being. His greater creation is a family, sons and daughters. In verse 15 of Isaiah 57 that we just read, he tells us the greatest power and love of an individual who tells us who he wants to reside with, those of a contrite and a humble spirit. When we begin to understand this Almighty God of faithfulness and the faithfulness that he shows to us, let us take that. Let us be encouraged and solidified as members of his eternal family.